Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
So Speaker Mike Johnson has seemingly pushed through some of the foreign aid that many in his own party were against. What will it cost him in the long run? Congress is also considering a lot of federal agency budgets as they hear testimony from their leaders. For an update on all fronts, we welcome back WTOP Capitol Hill correspondent Mitchell Miller. Mitchell, thanks again for joining us.
You bet.
All right. So, yeah, let's get the lay of the land here of, you know, exactly what Speaker Johnson was able to accomplish with a lot of help from the other side of the aisle.
Right. This is a very unusual situation, as you well know. For months, House Speaker Johnson really put off this decision that happened over the weekend, trying to figure out a way to walk this political tightrope with his conservative conference and a lot of opposition, frankly, to the aid to Ukraine. Initially, he really barely talked about it at all publicly, and then he really did a 180 last week and talked about it in really more traditional Republican ways. He talked about the fact that the United States needed to step up to this historic moment, that the U.S. needs to provide more military assistance. He said he actually went into the briefings and went into the SCIF to actually get the intelligence on this, and he encouraged other Republicans to do so, knowing that many would still oppose aid to Ukraine. But many people here in Congress think that this was a real moment, frankly, for House Speaker Mike Johnson, that he decided to pull away from all of the indecision that happened over the last few months and just decide to go forward. And as he said, let the chips fall where they may. And he knows that this does not allow him a lot of wiggle room here in the conference, because there is still that sword of Damocles hanging over his head, that they could have the motion to vacate and still potentially oust him. But there is also a number of Republicans that just don't want to bring upon more chaos within the conference.
Yeah, and the timing of it, not just, you know, the timing overall, the timing of the week that he decided to pull this maneuver, I think that warrants some discussion as well. You know, he knew that he was kind of between a rock and a hard place. So why not do it on a Friday, right?
Right. So they decided to bring up all these bills up separately. And that was another big thing for his GOP conference. They do not like these big omnibus, these big packages coming together. They want to take them discreetly. And that allowed him to get some political room within the Republican conference to allow this to happen. Now, you could argue that, at least from the Senate side, essentially all of this is the same pretty much as the Senate approved a couple of months ago. He did allow several other issues to be brought up in connection with these bills, and I think that allowed him, again, some of this political wiggle room within his conference. But it's certainly something that the Congress here has been waiting on for months, and it didn't allow many of them to move forward with a lot of other issues. Now the Senate will have to figure out exactly how it's going to navigate all of this.
Not to stay on this, but just wanted to know if there were any reactions from those within his own party that weren't going to be happy about this move pretty much either way. Have they been saying anything about that sword of Damocles you talked about?
Right. There's definitely this sector of the Republican conference, the House Freedom Caucus in particular, that has made it very clear that they were absolutely in opposition to this. But others on the more moderate side of the conference said, look, they are not going to be happy no matter what you do, speaking to Speaker Johnson. And so he basically made a political calculation that, all right, I'm going to have to make a break. And he's been with these conservatives for a long time when he was in the rank and file. But now he's in a very different position. He has to lead the party, such as it is, even though it only has, as he points out many times, that it has the smallest majority really in modern history. So these conservatives are going to continue to rail against him. Some of them, Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, for example, has basically called him a Democrat and said he's no better than Nancy Pelosi, the former House Speaker. So there is going to be some angst and turmoil within the Republican Party, to be sure, moving forward.
Learning about what leadership in Washington is all about right in front of us. We're speaking with WTOP Capitol Hill correspondent Mitchell Miller. Speaking of leadership in Washington, a lot of agency leaders were on the Hill this week discussing some of the budgetary items and what they need going forward. One of them in particular, the IRS, which is always a contentious fight for dollars with that agency. How did that hearing go?
Right. IRS Commissioner Danny Werfel, speaking before the Senate Finance Committee, essentially said, you've shown me the money and now I'm showing you results. He's telling lawmakers that he really wants billions of additional dollars to continue this modernization effort within the IRS. Now, of course, there's been a lot of skeptical Republicans as well as some Democrats about what this money would do. But essentially, before the Finance Committee, he outlined a variety of factors that show that the money is literally paying off. They are getting more people on the phone to get help, considerably more. You go back to the pandemic, only about 15% of the callers were getting through. Now it's close to 90%. And he said that's made a big difference. And then they're continuing this modernization effort with all their old IT issues. And he says if Congress can continue to keep the money flowing, and he says the agency is only requesting basically a flat budget for 2025, just over $12 billion, that will help the agency considerably. Now, the Biden administration has also called on Congress to reverse the $20 billion that was cut from the IRS in the Inflation Reduction Act. We'll have to see what happens there. But the IRS did make a pretty strong case last week that a lot of money that has been approved will also provide more revenue going forward in the years ahead. Obviously, as you alluded to, there's generally some skepticism about what the IRS can do and not do. But I think this was a little bit of a victory lap for the IRS Commissioner Danny Werfel.
A similar tune being sung by David Pekoske, head of the Transportation Security Administration, saying, hey, you know, look what happens when you actually give me the funding I need.
Right. As you well know, the TSA has had a lot of issues in connection with morale. And one of the biggest ones, of course, relates to pay. And what Pekoske told the House Appropriations Subcommittee last week is that this provision that allows them to essentially get into the system along with federal workers before they weren't allowed to get the type of pay increases that the average federal worker was going to get, because when they established the TSA after 9/11, they were essentially siloed into a different system. So it's been gradually improved and changed over the years. And essentially what he said is, you know, you give these employees more money, more security, and they are going to stay at the TSA. The TSA, as you're aware, has had major problems with a lot of people who just leave after a very short time of employment. And he said, what this has allowed the TSA to do is keep people within the agency and actually start to promote them. And he's just urging Congress to provide more money and just keep the dollars flowing.
Speaking of the nation's airways, the FAA is also in need of a reauthorization. And it actually brings up a concerning point for a local story that I'm sure WTOP is all over regarding Reagan National Airport. What can you tell us about that?
This is a really interesting issue. Last week, there was a near miss at Reagan National Airport. Two aircraft, one from JetBlue and one from Southwest Airlines, were basically taxiing down the runway. And you can actually hear the fear in the voice of one of the air traffic controllers telling one of the aircraft to stop. We reported on this, and it has caused a big stir in Congress because there is this continuing argument about what is going to happen with the number of slots and the additional flights at Reagan National. And there's been a real fight within Congress once again over this issue. And immediately after this came about, many of the lawmakers from Virginia in particular, including Jerry Connolly in the House and on the Senate side, Senators Tim Kaine and Mark Warner, issued statements saying this is another example of why they do not believe that more flights should be added to Reagan National. They have continually pointed out that Reagan National is perhaps the busiest airport in terms of the amount of air traffic that it gets, just because it just doesn't have a lot of runway space. And so the FAA authorization has been stretched out over the last few months. It's coming up again in May. So you can bet that this is going to be cited once again as this argument just goes back and forth over and over again to determine whether or not the Reagan National will get more flights.
Yeah, and just finishing up here, can we briefly talk about how crucial Reagan National is for the operation of Congress itself? You know, I imagine a lot of representatives needed to get to and fro, back and forth between their districts and here.
Right. And the real pressure has come from lawmakers, not surprisingly, who are from outside the area. Many of them, particularly in the West and the central parts of the country, including Texas, they point out that they have to drive potentially, and their constituents have to drive hours to get to an airport and then fly to Washington, D.C., for example, if they have to do business here. And they argue that it's really not adding that much air traffic to the overall operations at Reagan National. But as you're aware, around here in the delegation of Virginia and Maryland, as well as D.C., there has been a real pushback about trying to add these flights. Also, the airlines, some of the airlines want to add the flights, too. Obviously, it creates more revenue. So we'll have to see what happens. But I think this is going to be an ongoing struggle.
And as we continue to run out of room here in Washington, D.C., we'll always count on Mitchell Miller being there for us. WTOP Capitol Hill correspondent Mitchell Miller, thank you so much.
You bet.
And you can find this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it? And building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor and I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role, and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah. And worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.